pussy sweeter than a sweetie when I meet her in the morning.
The morning.
With the morning glory.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you will hear reminiscences of life around North Carolina's Triangle area, written by local authors. On today's program, I'll finish reading Heaven for Beginners, Betsy Holloway's reminiscences of her life growing up in Durham. Resuming in Chapter 8, Downtown. Regardless of how I arranged my mornings, Saturday afternoons were for movies, also known as picture shows. Durham had several theaters. The Center, billed as the showplace of Tobacco Land, and the Carolina showed first-run movies. Southeast of these two, down on East Main Street, you could catch return engagements at the Uptown, the Criterion, or the Rialto. For a brief time early in the 1950s, the Rialto also offered the Hayloft Opry, a live Saturday night version of what was then disparagingly referred to as hillbilly music. Still further east stood the Astor, which after years of showing third-run double features, came briefly to life around 1950 to offer such films as The Red Shoes and Ingrid Bergman's Joan of Arc. There followed a short, unsuccessful incarnation as an art cinema, and then a return to double features, this time on the order of Smashing the Vice Trust and Reefer Madness, while simultaneously questionable-looking individuals took to loitering ominously in front of the building. Wyatt Dixon recalls that in earlier days Durham had other theaters, the Dreamland, the Arcade, the Edisonia, and the Electric, the first to show pictures with sound. These were all in existence by 1909. The Grand, the Broadway, and the Strand followed. Movie times were 1, 3, 5, 7, and 9 p.m. every day except Sunday, when they were at 2, 4, and 9, to avoid conflicting with evening services at church. The theater's newspaper ads seldom bothered to mention starting times, which most people didn't care about anyway. If you arrived a few minutes after the movie had begun, or even during the middle, you just stayed through Pathé News, the previews, and Bugs Bunny until the main feature progressed to where you'd come in. If the film had a particularly surprising conclusion, the theater included a cautionary note in its advertising. Please see it from the beginning, and listed the telephone number to call for starting times. To underscore the thematic significance of such movies as Our Very Own, which dealt with adoption, or Pinky, a black girl passing as white, the ads advised solemnly, see it with someone you love very much. In the summertime, they also stressed the theater's air conditioning, which on very hot days was a better drawing card than the films themselves. The Center was the cool center. We manufacture our own weather / scientifically air-conditioned. While the Carolina's ads showed the theater's name with icicles hanging from the letters, or else piled high with frost. The best advertisement of all was a wordless one. When the Carolina's doors were opened, a torrent of cold air rushed vigorously outside, puffing out the triangular flags reading COOL that hung from the theater marquee. Although at one time or another I saw movies at every theater in town, for practical purposes my cinema world consisted of the Center and the Carolina, just a few blocks apart. The Carolina, a slightly aging but still imposing yellow brick building, beaux arts in style, had been built by the city in 1926, to provide a replacement facility for the old Academy of Music after the latter had been torn down to make room for the Washington Duke Hotel, originally christened the Durham Auditorium. This name is in fact carved into the marble facade. In 1929, the house was renamed the Carolina Theater. In addition to its large first-floor auditorium with elevated side boxes, the theater had two balconies, one of them colored. Together, the three areas could seat some 1,400 persons. The auditorium was designed to present touring stage productions, and during the 1920s and 1930s, it offered Duramites the opportunity to see outstanding actors and actresses starring in some of the most popular plays of the era. Catherine Cornell in The Barretts of Wimpole Street, Lewis Calhern in Life with Father, Katharine Hepburn in The Philadelphia Story. But by the time I began going there, the facility had been converted almost entirely to a movie theater, with only infrequent stage productions. The center, on the other hand, was comparatively new, having been built just before World War II. Located only a few steps away from the prestigious Washington Duke Hotel, and designed exclusively for showing films, it quickly achieved stature as Durham's leading theater. My visits to Thomas' bookstore always ended a few minutes before 1 o'clock, so I could cross the street to the center, buy my 9-cent ticket and a Nestle's Crunch, and hurry inside before the newsreels began. Those were the days when Will Hayes and the Motion Picture Production Code reigned, when prostitutes were dance hall girls, every bedroom had twin beds, and even a married couple who found themselves in bed together had to keep one foot on the floor, so that parents never worried about what movies a child saw. And I saw them all. The World War II movies with their clean-cut American heroes, buck-toothed Japanese, and bumbling Germans. The Randolph Scott and John Wayne westerns, where Indians and outlaws by the dozens sustained mortal wounds without ever shedding visible blood. The musicals, with Dinah Shore singing The Last Time I Saw Paris, William Warfield singing Old Man River, and Fred Astaire dancing on the ceiling. The comedies, with Bob Hope zooming through the air, and Abbott and Costello meeting Frankenstein, when they weren't snarling up the French Foreign Legion. A film based vaguely on Annette Kellerman's life had Esther Williams swimming in a huge glass tank, which broke. The charming, dark-haired child of National Velvet grew up before our eyes, first in A Date with Judy, and then in Conspirator. And Walt Disney used love-struck centaurs, dancing elephants, and an overconfident mouse to introduce classical music to the provinces. Warm-hearted family fare abounded. A southwestern wife and mother took in a fascinating assortment of boarders to whom she served chicken every Sunday. A pair of efficiency experts efficiently produced a mostly neatly regimented brood of 12 children, and a little boy's cherished black ram took grand prize at the county fair. And we cried and cried when the already angelic Beth March died, and when an agnostic young country physician returned to Joel McRae's fold of faith, and when lovable Bobby Driscoll's life was saved by kindly, wise, deep-voiced Uncle Remus. My mother was always pleased when the Cecil B. DeMille Biblical Spectaculars came to town, believing their subject matter to be of the uplifting sort that I should be watching instead of so many Bob Hopes and Abbott and Costellos, which she considered harmlessly entertaining but not of lasting value. For my part, I looked forward to such films as Samson and Delilah with only slightly less enthusiasm than I had for The Pale Face. And rightly so. Samson and Delilah had fewer laughs, it was true, but you had the exquisite agony of seeing the red-hot blade come slowly toward you on the screen, just as Samson, Victor Mature, meltingly handsome, saw it in the seconds before he was blinded. And then, at the very end, you had the triumphant exultation of seeing him, his hair grown back and his strength secretly returned, lift his sightless eyes to heaven to pray for help, before slowly, methodically, pushing against the two large pillars that supported the enormous temple, ignoring the jeers and shouts of the clearly doomed heathen crowd, until at last one of the pillars cracked frighteningly and moved ever so slightly, and the throng fell suddenly, dramatically, silent. And then, in the hush that followed, he continued to push, heaving all his giant strength against the pillars until they gave way and the mighty building collapsed, satisfyingly annihilating all the unbelieving scorners, including the temptress Delilah, played by Hedy Lamarr at her most fetching, in a succession of bare midriff costumes. DeMille films were always extra long, as befitted the importance of their subject matter, with soaring conclusions that almost invariably left audiences awash in tears. Around the middle, though, you could usually count on some easing of the mood solemn before things became too serious. A banquet scene would be followed by after-dinner entertainment that consisted of scantily clad, well-endowed young women swaying seductively to MGM's notion of Old Testament-era music. In deference to the code, however, navels did not show. As soon as the center's movie had ended, and the Art Deco curtain with its 100 eyes had closed firmly over the screen, I collected my books and packages to hurry out of the theater into the blinding sunlight and down Chapel Hill Street to the Carolina, arriving just when the newsreels were beginning for the 3 o'clock show. Seeing two movies in a row usually provided considerable variety. Flying Leathernecks, Marine Air Devils in Hot Pursuit, with John Wayne at the center, might be followed, for example, by Donald O'Connor and his Talking Mule at the Carolina. Or Elizabeth Taylor, breathtakingly beautiful in Father of the Bride, would precede raucous Marjorie Main in Ma and Pa Kettle. Or Betty Grable, glamorous as That Lady in Ermine, would be followed by the artless Anne Blythe in Mr. Peabody and the Mermaid. Since movies changed Wednesdays and Sundays, different films played at each theater nearly every Saturday, and it mattered little to me what was showing, because I went to see almost anything on the screen, 3 or 4 times if I could manage it. But on those rare occasions when the center was showing a movie I didn't want to see, or else that my mother wouldn't let me see, such as Stromboli, which was Ingrid Bergman's downfall, or The Yearling, which was too sad, it was easy enough to go straight to the Carolina and watch theirs twice. Movies were better the second time around anyway. When the second movie ended, it was 5 o'clock, and time to start home. If it were winter, in fact, the light was already beginning to fade. From the Carolina, lonely and deserted in the late afternoon, I walked up the hill to Chapel Hill Street once more, through Belk's and past United Department Store and Durham Drug, to Five Points, where I had to cross 2 busy streets to get around the hub, but once I did, I could look in the windows of 4 furniture stores that lined Main Street, where the north and westbound buses stopped. Usually, I had a few minutes to wait before either the Duke Hospital or Hillsborough Road bus came by, and then there was time to slip into the Tasty Bake Shop, across from the busy Amoco station, for macaroons or a cream horn to take home. By that time, my Cress's candy corn was long gone. And then, depending on which bus arrived first, I rode past tobacco warehouses, the Liggett and Myers factory, the Coca-Cola bottling plant, and down Buchanan, past grassy outskirts of the sedately Georgian Women's College, once Trinity, and before that, in an earlier, gayer incarnation, Blackwell's Racetrack. Or else we went down Gregson, past the 2 massive brick buildings that were Carr Junior High and Durham High School, staunchly fixed in acreage that early in the century had surrounded Playboy Brody Duke's fine mansion, and off the bus to walk the block to home just as darkness fell. Downtown is different now. Partly that's because my perspective has changed. The blocks I used to walk from east to west have become shorter, and the buildings smaller, than those that inhabit my memory. Mostly, though, the alterations are all too real, caused by the development of shopping centers, together with the fact that, from the early 1960s until the mid-1970s, urban renewal swept through Durham with the force of a tidal wave, leaving change and destruction in its wake. Hundreds of businesses, thousands of households, were relocated at a cost of millions of dollars. As Herald writer Al Wheelis summarized the project from his vantage point of 1976, first came the public hearings, then a multimillion-dollar bond referendum for public improvements, then planning surveys, and, finally, the bulldozers. Dozens of old landmarks were destroyed. Neighborhoods and community ties were disrupted as well, though the planners held that people were moved to, quote, comparable or better housing. Caught in the throes of one violent change after another, downtown nearly perished. The look of Main Street has changed dramatically. The sidewalks have been widened by several feet in order to accommodate new trees and shrubbery, while the street itself has narrowed and become one way. The library has moved to a large modern building a block north of its previous columned home. Parking spaces are now pleasingly numerous, and some of its former neighbors have played musical chairs. The Sears building now provides space for the Durham County Health Center, while the former Health Department building has become the Department of Social Services Eligibility Office. In 1966, the Malbourne Hotel fell slowly and reluctantly to a wrecking crew that marveled at the old building's toughness. The Durham County Judicial Building now occupies that entire block. The old courthouse, that was the backdrop for countless human dramas, now stands empty, waiting for imaginative restoration and new life. The Fashion, where so many brides-to-be took their hopes and dreams, has been torn down and replaced by a parking lot. The Montaldo's building still exists, revealing vestiges of its former pink elegance, but the firm itself has long since moved to the large shopping center south of town. Harvey's Cafeteria has disappeared, and the bustling, noisy corner where Walgreens stood has become a quiet park where weeping willows and crepe myrtles shade concrete benches. Silver's became H.L. Green, and then McCrory's, finally closing in 1970. Jones and Frazier left downtown 2 years later, after spending 55 years in one location. The Fidelity Bank was swallowed up by Wachovia, which subsequently moved out of the Gear Building. Except for the part housing Woolworths, that building was destroyed. The site where it stood is now a vacant lot where, underground, it is rumored, a fine, costly vault remains, and probably will remain forever, for it's much too heavy to be moved at any reasonable expense. Ellis Stone, Durham's best store since 1886, exists only under a different name and in another part of town. About a year after William Tallheimer of Richmond came to Durham to become a rice patient, Ellis Stone was purchased by Tallheimer's, which promptly built a large new store across the street and sold it 10 years later to move to a shopping center north of town. Ellis Stone's former space in the Hill Building is now occupied by the Central Carolina Bank, which has given the building its name. The Belk Leggett Building is gone. Across the street, the Roses Building stands empty, though the name can still be read on the tiles at the front entrance. The stately Washington Duke Hotel, the largest and most magnificent in the state, was destroyed in 3 minutes one December day in 1975, to Durham's disbelieving grief. A parking lot occupies its site, and the discussions that began the next year about the city's need for a downtown hotel continue still. Thomas Bookstore closed in 1956. Nothing that recalls the store and its array of books, porcelain, and crystal can be seen in the simple, functional Realty Company building that has replaced it. Five Points, once the city's busy hub as well as the downtown control center and transfer point for the city buses, is now crisscrossed with one-way streets. The Piedmont Building, home of the old White Way Lunch, was torn down in 1966 following a fire. A tranquil, tree-shaded plaza occupies that site. The tetrad of furniture stores, the bake shop, the crowded service station, and the westbound buses have all vanished, leaving no trace. All but one of the downtown theaters are gone. The Astor closed for the last time in 1954, after nearly 20 years of existence under its various names and identities. The River of Life Gospel Church now occupies, and presumably has sanctified, its site. The Rialto closed in 1970, after 52 years of operation, including its first 11 as the Orpheum. During its sunset years, from about 1962 on, it enjoyed a moderately successful renaissance as an art film theater. Around the corner, the Criterion lasted until 1975, after 43 years in the same location and under the same name, but its building has now disappeared. The Uptown closed in 1965 after a relatively short lifetime, only 37 years. The Center, for some 27 years the leader among downtown theaters, was among the first to go. It vacated its building in 1966 to be quickly replaced by the 1960s modern Home Savings and Loan Building. The street that led down by the side of the theater, where black patrons walked to buy tickets, has been replaced by a park. But the old Durham Public Library building still stands, the fortunate recipient of loving restoration that whitened the Ionic columns and revealed the lovely yellow brick that had been hidden under white paint for so many years. The First Presbyterian Church continues to watch over its environs, though there's less to watch for now that some former neighbors have vanished from the scene. The Cress building has been saved, its pinkish-gray marble staircase intact, and its facade newly cleaned to reveal beautiful peach, blue, and green terracotta tile decorations that never showed before. With newly darkened windows, the building now houses a number of offices. Viewing the changes in its neighbors with the serenity born of having spent 70 years in one spot, Baldwin's continues to sell women's clothing, although it no longer lends books at 2 cents a day. Woolworth's likewise continues operations at the site it has occupied since 1915, its exterior sign the same arresting gold letters on carmine red background, the Visit Woolworth's Luncheonette signs still in place. The long, waist-high counters, though, have been replaced by floor-to-shoulder shelves. Picture frames now enclose either blank orange sheets or photographs of anonymous models. And Mr. T and Garfield toys have joined the bubble pipes, Monopoly sets, and Slinkies. Both Eckerd's and Durham Drug remain in their old locations, dispensing prescriptions, greeting cards, cosmetics, and health aids, although the latter store now stands stubbornly alone but for one other shop, between a park and a vacant lot. Amos and Andy survives, now on Main Street, across from the old Belk's site, but still offering delicious hot dogs topped with the owner's homemade chili. And the post office stands proudly, its elegance mostly unblemished. The ceiling boasts a fresh coat of paint. Red and white geraniums bloom cheerfully in front of the building, and the American flag flies overhead, as it has for nearly 50 years. And in 1978, the Carolina Theater experienced a miracle of sorts. Beset by segregation struggles, and then by years of declining attendance, as the complexion of downtown changed, the theater that had provided the setting for so many superb stage productions was about to be razed when the Historic Preservation Society came to its rescue by having the building designated a National Historic Site. A Duke faculty couple, who had moved from New York to Durham in 1960, Montrose and Connie Moses, organized a group of friends and supporters into the Carolina Cinema Corporation, a nonprofit group dedicated to preserving the theater. They cleaned and scrubbed, scraped and painted, until the old building had regained most of her dignity, and subsequently, against the advice of those who warned that no one will come to downtown movies anymore, redefined the theater's role as that of an art film cinema. As such, the Carolina has successfully supported itself for 7 years, has in fact taken in well over $1 million in admission revenues. Now offering the best foreign and art films, the theater shows no signs of losing its appeal. A film distributor has termed it, with the possible exception of one in Miami, the premier art cinema in the South. And within the past 3 years, the mezzanine lobby has been freed from its dingy, wartime-blacked window state by Connie Moses and dozens of community supporters, who've transformed the room into a stunning rose and burgundy fantasy, complete with velvet sofas and curtains, ostrich feathers, and colorful three-dimensional theater memorabilia, a matador's costume, a fluffy tutu, a violin and bow, in frames that decorate the walls. The room, which the city has christened the Connie Moses Ballroom, now provides the setting for gatherings of the Friends of the Carolina, community meetings, private parties, and Sunday afternoon musicales. Vision, hard work, and determination have been rewarded. The Carolina thrives. Epilogue. Together with the visual alterations in downtown, Durham itself has changed. Tobacco and textiles, once the city's undisputed industrial giants, have been greatly weakened. While textiles suffer from foreign imports, the tobacco industry reels from blows inflicted by everyone from the American Cancer Society to the Surgeon General. Duke University, established and supported by tobacco money, now sponsors a quit smoking clinic, while a short distance away stands a bronze statue of the school's founder, cigar in hand, presumably viewing such sacrilege in patient forbearance. Durham newspapers maintain an uneasy balance between proliferating evidence of tobacco-linked health problems, which, to their credit, they report faithfully and fully, and an anguished awareness of tobacco's economic importance to their town and to the state. Caught on the horns of a painful dilemma, the city seems to be pinning its hopes on high-tech industry. Nearby, the Research Triangle Park, already 25 years old, houses chemical, electronics, computer, and software companies among its dozens of firms. North of town, meanwhile, three historic plantation lands, totaling over 5,000 acres, are to undergo commercial and residential development, the nature and impact of which yet remains unknown. In 1884, Durham's first historian wrote poetically of having viewed this busy little city, a town that in 16 years or less has grown from nothing to be a busy and prosperous city of over 5,000 inhabitants. In every direction could be heard the hum and buzz of machinery, mingled with the song of the saw and the sound of the hammer. Heavily loaded wagons and drays rattled over the newly made rock-paved streets. Magnificent buildings lined each side of the way. Elegant dwellings could be seen in the distance. Churches with their tall spires almost kissing the clouds stood here and there. Factory bells and steam whistles sent forth their evening signals. Everything is hurry and bustle. Progress and enterprise is evident on every side. And to think that where this proud and famous little city now stands was, a few years ago, almost a wilderness. Is it not a grand illustration of what enterprise and energy can do? By 1925, William Kenneth Boyd spoke approvingly not only of the town's spirit of work and its steady expansion of business and industry, but also its harmonious race relations, individualism, and increasing cooperation in causes related to public welfare. 25 years later, when tobacco and textiles still ruled, W.C. Dula wrote, "The death of the Confederacy gave birth to the city of Durham, and out of the ashes of hopes of the Southern people has been built a great and progressive city." Who will speak for Durham next, and what message will he bring? March 1986. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Triangle Yesteryear is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.